I next met with Dr. Chandra Balani, and to begin, we chatted about an issue that's been the subject of much of his research over the last few years, the use of maintenance chemotherapy in patients with non-small cell lung cancer.
Maintenance therapy at this point in time is utilized in approximately 40 to 45% of the eligible patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. The rest, 50% of them, are still not getting it, though they are eligible to get it, but they are not getting it. And that is because of the investigator's skepticism regarding maintenance therapy overall. So the two agents which are approved in the maintenance setting are pemetrexed and erlotinib. So pemetrexed is primarily being used in non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer where it is approved. And patients who have either received pemetrexed in the frontline setting along with a platinum compound, or those who have not received pemetrexed with a platinum compound, are being treated with pemetrexed. So pemetrexed is the most commonly utilized agent at this point in time based on the two trials. One was our study and one is Luis Paz-Ares' study, where there was a benefit both in progression-free survival and overall survival with maintenance pemetrexed. Now, erlotinib is used, but it is used probably to a lesser extent, and it is primarily used in patients with EGFR mutation-positive disease. So there are very few patients who get it as maintenance. They usually get it as second-line or third-line therapy instead of maintenance therapy.
And in terms of the people who don't use maintenance therapy, whether they're a community-based physician or an investigator, what are some of the common, arguments against it?
Well, the common arguments which the investigators make or the key opinion leaders make is that all patients on the placebo arm did not receive the maintenance drug. So in the JMEN study, which I have published in Lancet, we only had 19% of the patients on the placebo arm who received pemetrexed, though close to 60% of them received approved second-line treatments. So when we go back to the docetaxel maintenance versus second-line therapy trial, we see that approximately a third of the patients do not end up getting second-line therapy. Only 50 to 60% of them are able to make it to second-line therapy, and almost all get maintenance therapy. So if you compare those patients who receive maintenance therapy and those who receive second-line therapy, and with a one-third of them dropped out, the overall survival in that study was the same. But the investigators discount those one-third of the patients who do not make it to second-line therapy. So that is one of the reasons that they say that if you choose your patients correctly, that you will be able to show a same survival in those patients who get second-line therapy. But they discount the fact that a third of the patients fall off and probably die before getting to second-line intervention. So that is the main argument which is used.
Do you think that it is likely or possible for an astute physician to pick out those patients who are going to make it to second line or not?
Well, there is no way of picking out those patients, despite the fact that some investigators have argued this time and again, because if on a clinical trial with the closest follow-up you can have, one-third of the patients do not make it to second-line therapy, I don't know what other follow-up would be required.
So can you talk a little bit about the design and the results of the Point Break study and what you think about it?
So the Point Break study actually was not a maintenance trial per se. So the Point Break study is comparing the investigational arm of ECOG-4599, which was carboplatin paclitaxel with bevacizumab, followed by maintenance bevacizumab. And the comparison was carboplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab, followed by maintenance pemetrexed and bevacizumab. So in that trial, there was no maintenance question. There were actually comparison of two regimens. And with the comparison of the two regimens, also, the ECOG-4599 trial comes ahead a little bit as compared to the carbopemetrexed and bevacizumab arm. So in general, what we take from this is that all patients received bevacizumab on the study. So there was no real control arm in the trial. If there was one control arm in the trial, which was carboplatin pemetrexed, followed by pemetrexed alone, then that would have shown that probably it is equivalent. So we have seen time and again that where bevacizumab has been used in the maintenance setting, so let's take, for example, the ATLAS study, which was bevacizumab-eligible patients, Everybody got bevacizumab up front. And then in the maintenance setting, they were randomized to bevacizumab or erlotinib and bevacizumab. So you cannot really make an argument about maintenance bevacizumab because everybody got it. So that trial confirmed what Saturn had shown, that erlotinib is better than best supportive care because erlotinib is better than best supportive care in the Saturn study. So Atlas actually confirmed that and did not really tell us anything about bevacizumab. So the trial that will really show in designing the next study, we really cannot mandate that the same drug be given at the time of progression in the second line setting. So that day is now gone because we cannot compare a maintenance drug to placebo, though some investigators still argue that you can, but it'll never be done. So ECOG 5508 is the clinical trial, which is ongoing, looking at carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and then if they have responsive or stable disease, the maintenance therapy is either single-agent pemetrexed, single-agent bevacizumab, as was done in ECOG 4599, or the combination of pemetrexed and bevacizumab. So that trial is half done. There are 600 and odd patients on the study, and we need 600 more patients to complete that trial.
What do you expect to see in terms of toxicity and tolerability in the three different maintenance arms of the ECOG study?
So I think that the combination arm will be more toxic as compared to the single agent arms. So the single agent bevacizumab or single agent pemetrexed will probably be either similar or better than the combination arm. That's what I expect, but we don't know what it is. So if you look at Point Break trial, the question that you asked, the reason probably was that pemetrexed and bevacizumab were given after the three-drug combination in the investigational arm of the trial, and that probably did not show a benefit. But actually, if you break down the front part of the study and the second part of the study, pemetrexed actually wins rather than any other drug in that combination.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Meaning we thought that the maintenance part, which includes the two drugs, which is pemetrexed and bevacizumab, that was there increased toxicity during that portion of the trial leading to reduced survival and not meeting the endpoint of the trial. But what was seen is that there was benefit of the maintenance, even with the two drugs, though there was slightly increased toxicity. And it was not due to the maintenance part of the study. In the initial part of the trial, they actually saw that there was reduction in survival. So I think that if you go back and look at the trial which was done in Europe where they compared bevacizumab to bevacizumab and pemetrexed, the pemetrexed-bevacizumab arm actually was superior in terms of progression-free survival as compared to bevacizumab alone. But in the end, the survivals are not significant. So I still think that pemetrexed, though I have a bias because I've done the pemetrexed studies, has a role in the maintenance setting, and it is probably superior because both the studies have shown an overall improvement in survival. So the continuation maintenance also showed improvement not only in progression-free but overall survival. And the JMEN study, which did not have pemetrexed in the frontline setting, and compared pemetrexed to placebo, showing a 5.2-month improvement in overall survival. And I think the skeptics think that everybody should have gotten pemetrexed in the second-line setting on the placebo arm. And that will never be possible.
So in terms of non-protocol strategy nowadays, as we wait for more information to become available, if you consider a patient with metastatic adenocarcinoma, let's say they're somewhat symptomatic, you're concerned about them, what would be a strategy that you would likely utilize in terms of initial treatment, in terms of maintenance, both in a younger, healthier patient, as well as an older patient with some comorbidities?
So as I am part of ECOG, the ECOG regimen of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, followed by bevacizumab, makes sense. And the second option is that if the patient is not bevacizumab eligible, I treat them with carboplatin and pemetrexed, the combination of two agents, and then maintain them with pemetrexed. So the maintenance after carboplatin and pemetrexed, as you know, that we don't use cisplatin, we use carboplatin in the metastatic disease setting in the United States. Most of the investigators and the community physicians use the combination of carboplatin and pemetrexed, followed by pemetrexed as maintenance if they have responsive or stable disease.
So I've had a few cases sent in to me from oncologists that I thought I might run a couple of them by you just for your sort of, you know, initial. I'm sure you get emails all the time where people just sort of run cases by you. So I want to run a few by you. 61-year-old man who's a smoker, persistent URI, abnormal chest x-ray, then gets a CT, 5.9 centimeter right upper lobe mass, SUV22. He has 1.3 centimeter hilar and sub-centimeter right paratracheal nodes. The surgeon takes the patient directly to a VATS upper lobectomy. Moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma, 2 of 6 peribronchial nodes are positive, level 4 nodes, stage 3A, T2, N2, M0. How would you be thinking through that patient?
So this is the patient that we talked about in the adjuvant setting, that should this patient get chemotherapy alone or should the patient get combined chemotherapy and radiation? So according to just one trial, the IALT study, the patient is eligible to get 4 cycles of chemotherapy, like early stage patients who get. But I think that there is almost a 100% chance that this patient is going to progress in the mediastinum as the paratracheal lymph node was positive. So the patient does have microscopic N2 disease, though there was an element of paratracheal lymph node even prior to surgical resection. So an adequate thing would have been that the patient should have undergone mediastinoscopy. And if the paratracheal lymph node was positive, the patient should have received 3 cycles of neoadjuvant therapy prior to surgical resection so that he would have been rendered N2 negative, possibly or preferably. So at this setting, he is N2 positive post-op. I would give them combined chemotherapy and radiation. So I have approximately 36 or so of these patients who have treated them with combined chemotherapy and radiation, and they have done very well.
What regimen?
Oh, I give them weekly carboplatin paclitaxel and radiation therapy. And the radiation therapy is given to a 50 gray. And if I find them suitable thereafter, they're finished, and they still have a good performance status, I add 2 more cycles of therapy so as to complete the adjuvant course.
So here's a patient who actually entered the ECOG 1505 study that the doc had a question about. 70-year-old man with a remote history of tobacco use. Goes in for routine pre-op chest x-ray because he's having a TURP, and they find a 6 centimeter right lower lobe mass, SUV is 7, hilum, I guess hilar adenopathy, I don't know if it says hilum, 2.7 SUV. The patient has a right lower lobectomy via VATS, 5.3 centimeter mildly differentiated adenocarcinoma, wild type tumor. He actually goes into the ECOG 1505 study and, in fact, receives cis-pemetrexed, as you said, the common choice in that trial. But what he was asking about was the fact that the patient developed hypomagnesemia and azotemia during the adjuvant treatment. And how often do you see that, and how do you manage it?
So hypomagnesemia is seen in almost every patient who gets cisplatin. So the azotemia, I don't know how much renal failure did the patient have.
Yeah, it doesn't say.
So for hypomagnesemia, it's easy that you supplement the magnesium. We do it with magnesium oxide. So that is very easy to replace, and they are on continuous magnesium oxide tablets, and they do very well thereafter. And we supplement it also IV when they are getting their treatments with dehydration. Now, for renal failure, now this is one thing. If the patient has increase in serum creatinine and has any element of renal failure, I think cisplatin would be the drug which causes it. So I actually, either the patient, depending on the degree of renal failure, the cisplatin will have to be stopped or the hydration will have to be increased or supportive care has to be given to this patient or he should be switched to carboplatin. Because carboplatin we can dose based on the creatinine clearance, and it is easy to give an exposure of carboplatin that we are looking at.
Here's another case. 37-year-old woman, never smoker, comes in presenting with fatigue, has a little bit of hemoptysis, found to have a left upper lobe mass / consolidation, treated for pneumonia, no resolution, and then finally has a biopsy showing an adenocarcinoma, 3.4 centimeter left upper lobe mass on PET CT, no other activity. The patient has a left upper lobectomy via VATS, 3.9 centimeter adenocarcinoma, nodes negative. and I'll ask, how would you think through the case? And then we have the little kicker here that this patient also has an exon 19 EGFR mutation.
So this is a good patient. The patient still has early stage disease. And based on this, she's a T2. But I think that based on all the data that we have, it is less than 4 centimeters in size. So I would not give her chemotherapy at this juncture. I would not recommend chemotherapy to this 37-year-old woman. And she has had everything excised and all the lymph nodes were negative. Now the question comes up that she's exon 19 mutation positive. So the ISLC actually came out with their guidelines a couple of days ago, and they were published in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology and a couple other journals. And they recommend that once we have an early stage patient, that we should get EML4-ALK gene rearrangement and the EGFR mutation, even in the early stage patients, so as to treat them subsequently at the time of recurrence. There is no data yet showing the benefit of erlotinib in the adjuvant setting from randomized clinical trials, whether it should be given. From a phase 2 study that was presented as a poster discussion last year, that there was feasibility of giving erlotinib over a period of 1 to 2 years in the clinical trial setting. And the estimated survivals from that trial seemed to be better. But again, this is straight phase 2. It's very difficult to say that the overall survival is better. If the tumor has completely been removed and there is no evidence of tumor in that patient, will erlotinib work? That's the question that we need to ask. So there may or may not be a benefit, but patient is a 37-year-old with lung cancer. One could offer, for practicality's sake, to give 1 year of erlotinib, but that's not based on any randomized clinical trial data.
So does that mean that you do that at some times?
So I have given it to one patient. Despite the fact that I see so many patients, I've only given it to one patient. I gave him that option, and the patient agreed to take it. So I gave it to him. I don't have adequate follow-up still to say that it did any benefit.
There have been people who bring up the question of whether it could have an adverse effect in terms of recurrence. Are you concerned about that?
Well, the data is there. There was a Canadian study which was in unselected patients where gefitinib was compared to placebo after 4 cycles of chemotherapy in early stage non-small cell lung cancer. And actually, the survival was reversed with gefitinib showing a deterioration. But again, the study was stopped early because of slow accrual, and it was not powered to show. So it is also not definitive at this point in time. We do know that in stage 3 disease, in the unselected patient population who have stage 3 unresectable disease, when you give it after combined chemotherapy and radiation, there is no benefit. So again, as I said, you could give that option to the patient. But in this day and age, when everybody is going towards the molecular typing of these patients and also doing next generation sequencing, maybe we will get more information whether to give erlotinib or not, or whether to give any targeted agent after these patients have received standard combination chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting. So I think the role is still controversial.
So interesting that bottom line is it sounds like you would just observe this patient. Actually, what this physician did, for better or worse, I thought was kind of interesting, is to give her 4 cycles of adjuvant cis-pem and then just surveillance without any EGFR inhibitor. And I guess that brings up the question, this is a 3.9 centimeter tumor, suppose it had been 4.1.
Yeah, but in 4.1, we would have said, based on the CLGB study, that we would have offered chemotherapy. But then that is all semantics, 3.9, 4.1. I think that when we don't have any definitive data, I think to be a purist, we need to tell the patient that we do not have definitive data. And if we do not have definitive data to give them adjuvant therapy, I think that we may see more side effects and toxic effects, and the patient may then come back and say, why did I get chemotherapy? So the patient should be made aware that there is no real proven benefit if the tumor is less than 4 centimeters in size. But you're right that 3.9 and 4.1 probably doesn't make any difference, and the patient should be told about that. And some patients will agree. So like this patient, if he or she was told that there may or may not be a benefit and the patient agreed to take it, and the patient did not have any side effects, and it was only for a finite duration of 12 weeks, I think it is not a wrong choice. So the physician was not wrong in giving them four cycles of adjuvant therapy. But I agree with him not to give erlotinib until we get more definitive data from randomized trials. So the RADIANT trial will probably be reported. I don't know whether it is this year or the following year.
Anything new in terms of the role of surgical resection in stage 3 disease?
So in stage 3 disease, which is macroscopic disease in the mediastinum, I don't see a role of surgical intervention. In patients who have microscopic disease in the mediastinum, I think we should give three cycles of neoadjuvant therapy. And if the disease is cleared in the mediastinum, then these patients should undergo surgical resection. But if the disease is not cleared, I don't see a role, and they should be treated with combined chemotherapy and radiation. So for microscopic disease, which turns into N0, there is a role. But for those who have macroscopic disease, which still is there after neoadjuvant therapy, surgery does not provide an advantage. And especially after neoadjuvant chemotherapy and radiation, you should not consider a pneumonectomy. If pneumonectomy is warranted, the mortality is very high after chemotherapy and radiation. So at this point in time, for patients who have microscopic disease in the mediastinum, we are giving three cycles of neoadjuvant therapy. So for non-squamous, we're giving cisplatin pemetrexed with or without bevacizumab or carboplatin and paclitaxel for squamous cell.
And I noticed also you did a recent review article in a surgical journal looking at the issue of management of pleural effusions. Anything new or in thinking that whole thing through, is there anything that you think oncologists maybe ought to be more sensitive to, or is it kind of something that's pretty open and shut in terms of what to do?
No, I think that putting in a Pleurovac or Pleurex catheter, we have started to see an increasing use of the Pleurex catheter in these patients. And these patients can actually carry that catheter for a long duration of time without getting infected these days, if you take care of it correctly. So if there is a pulmonologist or a thoracic surgeon or a radiologist who is willing to do that, I think these patients actually tolerate chemotherapy very well rather than coming back and forth for their intervention for either thoracentesis or a chest tube placement. And the incidence of chest tube placement has decreased remarkably over the last decade. So I think that there has been an advancement and their quality of life is much better with the Pleurex catheter because the patient can actually take it out. There is not an increased chance of getting a pneumothorax, and it is just a one-way valve and it is very easy to manage actually. And I've seen that my patients do very well. But again, I think that I commented on this a couple of years ago, that patients with pleural effusions actually do worse as compared to those who have metastatic disease. So if they just have pleural effusions, which are massive, these patients actually do not do well, even with intervention or chemotherapeutic intervention.
Interesting.
That's been my... But there is one other thing which actually, anecdotally, I will point out. If the pleural effusion gets infected and they develop an empyema, they have actually better control of their disease thereafter. So that brings in the concept of immunotherapy for these patients, that fighting the infection, the body's immune activation probably is leading to that. So if I've had a patient who has developed empyema during the course of that catheter, those patients have done remarkably well. And I cannot explain it.
Remarkably well.
Remarkably well, meaning, so I'll give you an example of a patient who got two cycles of chemotherapy, developed empyema, ended up in the hospital, was on a ventilator, never got more chemotherapy thereafter, and actually had stable disease for over 2 years.
Wow.
So this is anecdotal. This is not science, or there is no studies, and nobody will be able to do it. But so long as they get rid of their empyema by adequate treatment with antibiotics, these patients do well. And that may be that mechanism of the checkpoint inhibitors, actually, that we are talking about. That blocking PD-L1 with PD-L1 antibody prevents the interaction of PD-1 and PD-L1, and that probably is what happens in infection, that you have an activation of the T-cell. But I think that is a long shot.
So here's another maintenance-type question, kind of the other side of the coin, so to speak. 71-year-old man with stage 4 adenocarcinoma, has pulmonary mediastinal mets, receives carbo-pem for four cycles with a PR. Again, comes to you for a second opinion about what to do at this point.
That is very easy. You would give pemetrexed as a maintenance until progression. or toxicity. So that's what I do. And I have patients who are on maintenance pemetrexed, some of them for over 2 or 3 years.
And actually, that's what this patient received. But also, it's just kind of interesting. It doesn't say why the patient didn't receive Bev. And I was going to ask you this before when you were talking about the adjuvant Bev trial in terms of the issue of age. This patient was 71. Is there an age at which you start pulling back from Bev?
So we did the analysis of ECOG 4599, that patients who were over 70 years and less than 70 years of age, and we found that patients who were over the age of 70 years actually did not benefit from bevacizumab in that large randomized study. But it was not a pre-planned analysis. It was post-hoc analysis, and we have published this in the Journal of Clinical Oncology.
What's your own practice? Do you start pulling back from Bev at an arbitrary age if somebody's otherwise well?
Meaning, I think that physiological age matters rather than an arbitrary age. So if you think that the patient who's 75 years of age is behaving like a 65-year-old, so I think that there I would give it. But if physiologically these patients have an ECOG performance status of 2, or they have social circumstances where you do not really think that the patient will be able to carry forth his daily activities, you do not want to make them suffer from the third drug.
This concludes our program, and please note that subsequent to these interviews, which took place during April and early June of 2013, erlotinib was approved on May 14th, and afatinib was approved on July 12th, 2013, for first-line treatment of patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer whose tumors have EGFR exon 19 deletions or exon 21 L858R substitution mutations. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.